Hi, everyone. Yeah, I want to add just a special thanks to Bloom, who reached out to have us. And as a huge cider fan, I'm going to not name names, but there might have been one place we did an Issues and Ale where I actually snuck in cider so I could have a Snyder doing it. So this is super exciting. More exciting, though, than the three gentlemen to my right, who I love dearly, but there's someone way cooler today in the audience. And that is the new host of Stateside. Miss April Bear is in the house. For those folks over here, she's fabulous and she looks super cute. Sorry you can't see her. Oh, am I allowed to? I can say that if woman to woman, right? That you look super, you look great. Thank you, everyone, for being here. I know everyone is taking time out of a very busy schedule to talk politics, which is really bringing out the best in all of us these days.
I want to have a discussion about way cooler.
I mean, she's really cool, honey. Sorry. And Rick and I just recently got engaged, so any marital banter, it's just, I was going to say it's not awkward, but it is because we're in front of an audience, so we're going to try to keep it out, you know, from you guys. Dirty laundry stays at home. So Rick Pluta, my life partner as well as my work partner, co-host of Issues in it, or of It's Just Politics. Happens to also be the Capitol Bureau Chief of the Michigan Public Radio Network's Lansing Bureau. We have Selma Tucker to his right, Vice President of Public Sector Consultants. And one of the really, really cool things that we'll talk about with Selma, and by cool, I mean work-related, not that I'm giving my opinion, is that Selma is helping to lead a ballot proposal to extend LGBT rights into the state constitution. And finally, to his right, as they gossip, is Matt Marsden, a Republican strategist. Pick up your mics, gentlemen. Let's make this official. Matt has worked for a presidential candidate, for a governor, for three Senate majority leaders, for a member of Congress. A lot of institutional knowledge here with the three gentlemen combined. So we decided we would start out talking tonight about Governor Whitmer's State of the State address, which a week feels like years in these timelines of politics these days. But let's start a little with the speech. Matt, I want to start with you, and then we'll do kind of a round robin. How did the speech go? Historically, one of the shortest that we've seen in Lansing in years and years. What'd you think?
I'm sure everyone appreciated that. They tend to go on a long time.
Apparently, Governor Blanchard did an hour and 38 minutes one year.
I think that she probably received some undue criticism from her first one, being new to it. And I think that she was going to stick to some issues that were fairly concise. Roads, which she's kind of got herself in a situation where fix the damn roads means that she's in a pressure spot to fill that. Her decision to go down the road of bonding will be an interesting decision to see how it goes out. I think she hit on education, especially preschool education, and funding that, which I think is wise. And I think that she touched on the environment. And I think for right now, in a year when she's now being tapped to give the State of the Union response, it's probably in her best interest, knowing that a little bit in advance, to keep it as short and simple as possible.
Well, not just short and simple, but we've been given word that once they get through state of the state priorities, that we will hear. Is that better, Bob? that she'll be using the soapbox of special messages to call on the legislature to handle particular things. And it's actually a good one for a governor to use, because what governors propose in State of the State addresses can really get just lost. Yeah. Use your microphone.
They can get harangued.
Yeah, no, but they can really get lost just in the morass of programs and details. So if she goes that route, then that will allow the governor to focus on particular priorities throughout the year.
Selma, you were in Lansing watching this speech. You are inside the Lansing bubble. What did you think of the speech, and what are folks around Lansing saying?
Well, today, what is this? It's Issues and Ale, and you guys are the hosts of It's Just Politics. Yeah. I think that was kind of her speech. It was pretty. It was pretty political, and she made not a lot of promises. Right? We said how short it was, but it's also true that what she's doing here is she's not tying herself up into too many knots. She said, "I'm going to deliver a shorter speech than usual." That's because she wanted to talk about education. She wanted to talk about infrastructure. She wanted to talk about health. Care and she wanted to talk about the economy. And the fact of the matter is, those are the exact same things that propelled who to victory in 2018? The Democrats, right? So she's going to be speaking to those bread and butter pocketbook issues.
And I want to talk a little bit about, you know, predictions for what she is going to say in the response to the State of the Union tomorrow night, because I think it's probably going to be similar. Matt, from a Republican perspective, I got to say we were in the document room, which is this tiny little kind of room that's right next to the House floor, so you can see in. And man, I can't tell you how many times the governor would deliver a line or deliver a message, and one half of the room stood. And the other half of the room did not. Rick, this was your 33rd, sorry to put that out there publicly, State of the State.
I'm glad to still be here.
State of the State address. How, is that normal, right? It felt like, I remember past speeches that we've done and been there where, like, Democrats stood sometimes for Snyder and Republicans stood sometimes for Granholm. This just felt like Republicans, no matter what Whitmer said, were just not going to stand up.
As Zoe would say, I'm going to push back a little. I think that it was pretty typical in the sense that she was going to have to work very, very hard to come up with things that would get the Republicans on their feet applauding, and especially in the environment that's here right now.
And I think I come from a Republican background that's not the Republican Party today. I think if you look back at some of the folks that I've served and what you're seeing today in regards to the impeachment hearings and the ultra-hyper partisan side of stuff, it's not a Republican Party that I'm familiar with anymore. It's hard to sit and say, well, you know, Republicans are doing this or that, because I have a hard time agreeing with a great deal of decisions that they're making these days, from anything from what you're working on to the Elliot Larson changes and other things. But in terms of...
We got Republicans.
What's that?
Joe Schwartz.
Well, that's right. I worked for, you know, what we were called rhinos. We were driven out after one term in Congress by the Club for Growth because we were willing to work across partisan lines, and we were willing to work with labor on issues that were specific to the district that Joe represented. So I think that just given the nature of where this country is right now in terms of their politics, I'm not surprised that she's having the problems that the response that she got from the state address.
Well, and Republicans were expecting her to drop bomblets on them, and she did not disappoint.
No, and she's going to a scale that I think she's going to find out tomorrow is a whole different tier. I mean, to be asked to give the response to the State of the Union address tomorrow, if you look back historically, whether it be Republican or Democrat, that is an awfully difficult task to have. And with this president, it'll be even more difficult because she won't know what he's going to say and have maybe 10 minutes to prep to make adjustments. Sometimes
it's
crazy.
Response. But another thing about that that's interesting, and obviously you have to operate within the circumstances that you're dealt. And, you know, she is a Democratic governor in the age of Trump, but that also means that she's got an ambitious agenda underway that she was largely denied in year one, and now that she's gaining this national prominence, that Republicans are going to be that much more invested in blocking almost every element of that agenda.
You can look at her, what she talked about in her State of the State, and what was the most aggressive thing she put out there from a policy proposal?
Bonding?
Bonding, $3.5 billion dollars that she doesn't
even
need the legislature
sexy,
for.
I mean, it's super sexy, right? Bonding.
Right? I mean, you know, very exciting. And then maybe the other one is enshrining certain parts of the Affordable Care Act into state law, like the Medicaid expansion, covering pre-existing conditions, right? Like, these are really, really popular things and got no chance of going anywhere in the legislature, but they're very, very popular politically. So I think, yeah.
And she sent a letter today to the Trump administration trying to preserve portions of that.
Yeah.
Do you think, Matt, and then Selma, I want to go to you from the communications perspective, but, you know, I want to, Matt, really quickly go back to you. You said that this is a different Republican Party, you think, that was watching Whitmer. So do you think that some of the lawmakers in the House or the Senate who didn't stand, if they were in a different time, would have stood and clapped, and it's just simply we can't do that for each other anymore? Or is it really just policy-wise they can't get behind the ACA, as Selma was saying?
I think it's the era of, I think you're seeing in its full evolution term limits, okay? That's what you're seeing. These folks don't really care. They're there for their base. They don't want to be primaried. They're going to do whatever they need to do. You're seeing the same thing at the national level. Nobody wants to say that what is going on with impeachment is wrong because this man holds the party strings to the funding that there's required for people to get elected. And if we're just being bluntly honest about it, that's the reality. They're scared of stepping out of line, and on the other side, there's a level of ignorance that is born of term limits, where relationships have not had the time to develop like they used to back in the day when Joe Schwartz was running the higher education budget and would work with Morris Hood and would do what he was doing to get higher education budget to where it needed to be, and they would work with Jacob Eddy, and you had this group of people that were just old school guys that had worked here in the legislature for so long that's lost, and there is no collegiality anymore amongst elected officials.
Yeah, sure. Well, I really think that I couldn't agree more with the fact that the legislators are not necessarily talking to each other, and they don't have the respect for each other that they used to have. You see that at the federal level, and it has gotten so toxic, right, in the state. I mean, it's so ugly that it doesn't matter which side of the aisle you're on. You can pretty well take to the bank that if the opposite side says it, I mean, they're just not going to go for it. Let's remember, the Affordable Care Act was what? It was a Republican idea before it was a Democratic idea. So these things...
A Mitt Romney idea.
Thank you, Governor of Massachusetts. So we are in... If it's north, it's south. If it's east, it's west. It doesn't matter. I always have to go to the opposite side of you.
I have to disagree.
Oh, come on, Merrick. Give it to me.
Sure. That we are seeing elements of cooperation, and I think that sentencing reform is a prime example of that, where you've got some areas where I guess you'd say that you know, the conservative civil, the conservative libertarian side circles around and connects with the liberal Democrat civil libertarian side. And so you've got, you know, some of these issues. And like I said, I think that corrections and sentencing reform are prime areas of that, that it deals with fiscal frugality, it deals with containing government overreach and personal freedom. And so we are seeing some of those places.
I think. And also, from a policy perspective, it's also happening on energy. So not to get too wonky on you, but you do have these two sides that are so far apart.
You do work for the political sector.
I do work for public sector, so I gotta get a little policy on you, that are coming together around distributed generation, because you have the folks on the right who wanna you know, take a whack at the incumbent utilities, and you have the folks on the left who really, really want that rooftop solar, and they're saying, well, you know, we might be able to make a deal on rooftop solar and distributed generation because it goes after my enemy.
And Republicans who represent rural areas where some of their farmers are struggling, and they're seeing wind turbines as a potential source of
big revenue
as well.
Yep. And you're also seeing a large difference in the decriminalization of things, because you have an industry that's emerging here in Michigan with cannabis and with the hemp industry, and that is going to require folks to look at some of the things that people were put in jail for many years for something that is now recreationally and medicinally legal, and is also a very important agricultural commodity in terms of hemp and what it can do, from clothing to gases to any number of plastics. So I think that it's all a function of kind of a larger change that's happening, but both here in Michigan as well as across the country.
So as you can tell, we would just keep talking, and we will. But let's take a break for some questions before we go on to talking a little bit about why Governor Whitmer was chosen to deliver the Democratic response. So why don't you throw your hands on, and Suzanne, if you want to start on that side, and I'll keep my eyes over on this side. Hi, everyone.
Hi. Do you see any hope for changing the term limits law that's in place now? Is there any movement on that?
Yeah. So this is really interesting because it's one of the things when we have really, really smart people at tables like this and you ask them, it used to be just off the record and they would say, we've got to change term limits. And it was like term limits and gerrymandering, dark money. And now more and more folks at tables like this are very openly saying that it is term limits that has led to some really disastrous issues in the state. The problem is, though, and I want to hear more from Matt and Selma on this, that the polling still shows that voters like term limits, right? It's this idea of making sure that fat cats eventually get kicked out of office and that bringing in new blood. But as we've learned in Michigan, that's not necessarily what happened. And you end up having folks at this table who truthfully know a lot more than some of the state reps that walk in on day one. And maybe even worse in some voters' minds, lobbyists who have really become civil servants in some respects.
The institutional memory.
Because they're the ones that actually know what's going on. Matt, talk to me a little bit about this idea that we said, I mean, we've been how many issues in AL where it is, we got to get rid of term limits, and yet it's going to cost millions and millions of dollars to try to do it. Is that ever going to happen?
No, it's not. It's not going to happen, unfortunately. It's not going to happen, and it's one of those things that you look back historically, politically speaking, that at the time everybody thought was this really lovely idea, and it really turned out to be that, again, and going back to the fact that it ended long-term relationships that allowed people to bridge very difficult issues. Let's use the higher ed budget, for example. Since 2003, funding for higher education in our public universities is down one-third, okay? We used to be among the top three in the country for our public universities, but because of term limits, there isn't the Joe Schwartzes and Morris Hoods of the world that were able to work it out and say that Northern Michigan needed this, and that yes, U of M had this endowment, and that MSU needed this, and that public we were pricing our kids out of a public education right now, the way it is. And, you know, that was something that didn't happen from 1993 to 2003. That budget remained consistent. And it's not that way anymore, but that consistency was born of people being able to hang out and play cards with each other in the evenings. They were friends. These guys were friends. They disagreed with things greatly, but at the end of the day, they were all
They
friends.
Yelled at each other during the day.
They yelled did. At each other, but they also had a beer at night and mm-hmm. laughed yeah. about it.
Hawk and Dove.
You know that.
Selma?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Matt, because you have these two sides that used to have a lot more conversation with each other, and you see it playing out in the discussion around the roads, right? So what happened? Whitmer comes out and says, well, you know, you wanted to reform the teacher's pension system. That's not a serious reform. You wanted to go at it from a different approach. That's not a serious reform. And so Republicans are saying, well, we gave you something and you just didn't like those things. So we're both going to pack up our toys and go home. And they both want to blame the other for why it didn't work out.
Again, I've got to push back though a little bit on just that. I do think that term limits is a big part of that. But what we've seen in the discussions about road funding and the budget is that sometimes the Republican leadership has stood together, and sometimes a Republican leader has shown some willingness to engage in some kind of deal-making with the governor, but not all three of them at the same time. It's perpetually been two against one.
But what you saw Governor Whitmer do here, which is interesting, and well, there's no love lost between she and I going back to the Bishop days, but the reality is that she made a unilateral decision to bond. And she said, I'm not going to wait around for you guys. I'm going to do this, and I can do this. And let's remember, Governor Engler bonded. Governor Granholm bonded. It took one tough nerd to come back for two terms to fix the bonding debt. and now we're talking about bonding again. The reality on roads is,
and there is one thing about bonding that everybody agrees on, though, which is it's not enough to fix the problem.
Yeah, let me talk about that for a second. So this $3.5 billion is really interesting. So this is PSC research and others as well. We need about $15 billion over 10 years just for the trunk lines, right? That's the major stuff. Those are the roads with an M. Those are the roads with an I. Those are the really, really big roads that we're talking about. We're not talking about the local roads. $15 billion for that. In an estimate, and we don't really know the estimate for the locals, around $10 billion. But we actually have less specificity around that number. So an order of magnitude of around $25 billion over the course of 10 years.
Now my fiscal conservative hat's coming on going, that is I get it. That's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. I mean, when you have a general fund that is what? $9 billion and has been the same for more than a decade. And in real dollars, our general fund has decreased significantly over time. So $3.5 billion, and guess how much the debt is going to be? How much we will pay in interest on that $3.5 billion?
So
what's your guess?
I don't even want to guess.
What's your guess? Anybody want to guess? $3.5 billion. How much interest will we pay on that $3.5 billion? I don't know the length of term.
I think it's a 15 to 30, but I don't know how they're doing the bonds these days because we haven't been able to. The state, you guys got to remember, the state was never in a place to even get a bond.
It's better now.
It's better now.
It's much
for
better.
Sure. But I mean, you know, there was a time, just remember everybody, about 4 to 6 years ago where this state, Moody's, had us, and Standard & Poor's had us down so low we couldn't even get a bond.
I think they call that junk status.
Yeah,
yes.
Pretty much. So I don't even know what term they would give us, a 10 or 15 or 30, but.
$1.7 billion. That's how much we're going to pay in interest for the three. We're going to get 3.5, and we're going to have to pay that 3.5 back plus 1.7, which we're going to have to defer from maintenance later on. So it's not that can that you hear going past you. Yeah, that was kicked.
But at the same time, they have to do that because you have to understand if she wants to actually get the roads fixed as she said she was going to do to fix the damn roads, to use her words, they have to have that money allocated and set aside in order to start the projects by spring. Right? I mean, that. So there's a bit of it when she says patience. Part of her thing is also she's looking at this from a pragmatic standpoint that she knows she's got to have that funding set aside or else she can't start the whole tour.
Well, she's got her talking point for the next year, right? So you said it's always two against one. Oh, I'm sorry, Zoe. I'll let you get in. It's always two against one. Yeah. Well, you know, maybe she'll get a second. You think she'll get a second dancing partner?
Well, maybe she'll be the next vice president, and then we'll leave it to Mr. Gilchrist.
You're already going there.
So
we're not even going into presidential
politics. We started the question on term limits. You can see why we invite these guys, and this is like with only half a drink each. They're the best dates ever, and as a reminder, please, while we're talking, feel free to jump up in the bar. Maybe you're going to need it if we continue to talk about roads. I think the question right about term limits and the discussion that we're having right now, a lot of is happening because people outside of Lansing are looking in and seeing that nothing seems to get done, right? And there is frustration in Lansing. There's frustration in D.C. Some of it is because of term limits. And some of it, Selma, as you exactly said, is kicking the can down the road. No,
some of it's just stupid.
And some of it is just plain stupid. And folks trying to keep their jobs. And look, you know, as I'll steal a line from Rick Luda, is, you know, how many times have you not done something to try to keep your job? Now, I'm not saying something unethical, but, you know, when we talk about lawmakers trying to get voted in office again, they're trying to keep their jobs. Now, that is not an endorsement of doing things that aren't good for the folks that vote for them.
And it's not really that high paying of a job, so I don't quite
really
want to keep it.
Amen.
But the thing is, the idea that you're going to do something to appeal to voters in order to keep your job, that's the way it's supposed to work.
So, well, Heather,
Luda,
if that's the case, then we'd have those roads fixed.
Yeah. So let's open it up a question on this side of the room.
Not true.
Not true.
You're going to make us keep talking, then, are you? Okay.
I'm sorry. So the $9 billion is a steady amount of funding.
That's the general fund.
What about taxing cannabis for the roads?
I think that's already in there, 10%. And, well, the cannabis is the lowest in the country, I think, as far as taxes are concerned.
Yeah, now the taxing's in there for infrastructure. However, the state, and this is an area where the governor is going to need to look at it, has become way overly burdensome in regulations on the industry. And if you want the industry to work, you've got to take a look at what else has happened, or else you're You can't have municipal opt-outs where, aside from this community...
1,400, I think.
I mean, aside from this community here, there is no real recreational market. And if you want to generate revenue, and we're talking not about a small amount of revenue from the sale of cannabis, hemp, and its byproducts, you have got to figure out how to sort out the regulation issue, as well as the fact that these municipalities have been left in control of opting out where there won't be enough revenue.
But bringing it back around to his question, here's the issue, is that cannabis for roads is like lottery for school.
It's called pot for potholes.
Yeah. It's nothing.
But it's like... It's like the lottery for schools. You're right. It's not nothing. Just like the lottery.
But the TV ad told me it was $1 billion in my scratch-off tickets went to public education.
Right. But it's still, it's a lot of money. It's too much to get rid of, but it's not enough to fix all the problems that people say.
I do remember, Selma, that Whitmer last year at some point someone had done some math, and it was something like, every Michigander over the age of 18 would have to smoke like $1,200 a pot a day in order to pay for all
get
the
work
we needed. Everyone in this room is like, throw me in, coach.
And that being said, the first month of legalized recreational marijuana in this state generated over $10 million in sales in 1 month.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's not small potatoes. Okay, so we don't have any questions on this side more. Yes, yes. So let's, before we bring it back to this side, talk a little bit about why Governor Gretchen Whitmer was selected to deliver the response to President Trump. Rick, you talked to the governor a few days ago, and she said she's going to be rewriting her 10-minute speech up until the last moments. She's got a certain amount written, but then she's going to maybe change stuff at the last
minute. Because look who's going to be delivering the State of the Union address. So, I mean, you don't really know what's coming, and a lot of it. She was chosen by the Democratic congressional leadership to deliver it, and the reason is November, and that she is basically the kind of public image that Democrats want to project in November, that Michigan is a state with a critical number of electoral votes, and it's emblematic of a lot of the problems that a lot of people in the country see, that emblematic of the industrial Midwest, emblematic of blue-collar workers who are wondering what's going to be next for them as the economy evolves.
Selma, you work in communications. You advise people often about how to present. What it would be your advice if you were advising, and I don't know, maybe you are because it's you and you know everybody and do everything in Lansing. Maybe you're advising the governor. What would you tell
her?
I am not.
What would you tell her to do? What advice?
Stay hydrated. That would be the first one. Stay hydrated.
Poor Marco Rubio.
I would, this is an unenviable task to do this. And I don't know. Maybe Rick can tell me. I don't really know why she would do it. I would love for you to game that out for me. Like, what is the upshot for her being the response to the State of the Union?
I think that they're putting on my strategic hat and looking at it from a Rev6 data systems pure political numbers perspective. First of all, she is a female governor from Michigan. Had Hillary Clinton maybe listened to some outside counsel in 2016 and done a few things, she might have found the 12 or 13,000 votes that she needed to win Michigan, which would have effectively stopped Trump. That being said, if she does become the VP nomination, what does she do? She leaves Michigan with the first ever African-American governor, which is a big deal when it comes to the politics of Detroit, and you got to have Wayne County if you're going to win the state. So there are little small things strategically that I can see why they're doing what they're doing. It is just a huge mantle for her to have to carry.
Well, I think she's got two things that are interrelated. One, you asked me the question, and I will let you get in here, Rick. She's got to stick to those pocketbook issues, which is exactly what she did in her State of the State, and they're going to replay exactly what they did in 2018. They're going to be talking about healthcare over and over again. If you look at her speech, she spent the most of her time on healthcare, and they're going to be drilling that home all day long. And I think that's where she's going to end up. You'll probably see a reprisal of her State of the Union speech at her response to Trump.
Mm-hmm. I think you're absolutely right, and that was one of the things that we were talking about earlier, that if you're
being... And he meant State of the State.
State of the State, yeah, SOS.
That if you're being very smart and strategic, you don't want to get into a food fight. I also don't really think that is a Gretchen Whitmer with this president. And do exactly what Democrats did in Michigan in 18, which was purposefully didn't talk about Donald Trump. I mean, Bill Schuette did, you know, Brian Kelly had to, but on the Democratic side, Trump was not brought up. Instead, it was education, it was healthcare, it was those pocketbook issues, as you said, and my gut says that maybe she'll mention, you know, Trump and respond and say the president, but she wants to talk about issues that matter, and we also know she told... I love this. The Department of Transportation in Michigan has its own podcast. And she told them today, breaking news, that she's planning on talking about transportation in her budget. You heard, or in her speech.
I heard it here.
There's also another.
Quickly just give a plug for you, is ballot issues are super important in presidential years. Mm. And the Elliot Larson ballot proposal
is the one to expand Michigan's Civil Rights Act to cover...
There's no reason that anybody should be discriminated against in the workplace or in the rental market or housing market because of their sexual preference or their gender.
Or anywhere else.
But you get my point. But and so having something on that, like that, on the ballot in this presidential election year, it drives out people that are millennials and younger voters that are going to be respectful of that.
And there's some conversation that that's what happened in 18 as well, right? We had the gerrymandering ballot. You had the legalization of marijuana.
And in 16, Hillary Clinton was offered the opportunity to move a legalization ballot. They wanted to save it for 18, and it may have cost her that 12,000 votes.
Rick, though, the political calculus, as Selma asks, John Selleck, who worked for Bill Schuette, had my favorite line this week, who said, delivering the response to the presidential address is like cotton candy. If it goes well, it kind of melts in your mouth after a few minutes, you forget about it. And if it doesn't, it just sticks to your fingers constantly. Mm. And we all are making jokes about staying hydrated. And that's Marco Rubio, who you may remember. They're just like, poor guy got so, like, his lips were so dry, you could hear it through the TV. And then he goes and looks for the water. Like, these are the things that we remember. Why wouldn't she just be like, I'm good, thanks, bye.
And the answer is no guts, no glory. That there are risks, but when an opportunity like this comes your way, whether it's to deal with personal ambitions, with issue-related ambitions, and the two are certainly not mutually exclusive, you take it.
It's not easy to be a minority leader for 8 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, I worked in the chamber.
You're talking about Gretchen Whitmer.
For the governor. And for 8 years, she was the loyal opposition for the Democrats in the Senate. And that's an untenable place to be. It's not fun. So when you finally get the opportunity to be where she is right now, I think that she's a female. B, she's from Michigan, middle of the Midwest. We have Klobuchar from Minnesota running for president. Who knows what's going to happen? But that kind of leaves her as the de facto person in the Midwest that can be a voice. And she should take the opportunity. It's once in a lifetime. You roll the dice.
Well, I just don't see how you don't.
Well, it's also the only way she's going to potentially get any of this stuff done. So you said my line was it takes two to tango, and she's looking for a dancing partner. Earlier you said she needs two out of those three. Mm-hmm. So she wants a Democratic House, and the only way she's going to do that is if she really, really runs up the totals in 2020.
Interesting, and we also know just today it was announced that she's going to deliver it from East Lansing High School, which is where her two daughters go to school, so obviously we'll be mentioning education. It is also where Rick Pluta's son goes, and Rick texted him tomorrow and was like, the governor this morning was like, the governor's going to deliver this speech from your school, and he's like, what speech? April, you have a question.
I have a question.
Wait for the microphone, April. Be a professional.
She's new.
I'm kind of notorious for not needing microphones. Please explain to this former Buckeye.
But now Michigander.
Recent former Oregonian from the unschooled West Coast. Sometimes the optics of a choice for the rebuttal is relatively broad. I mean, yes, it's not hard to understand if the Democratic Party taps a woman governor from a swing state that went for Trump by the slimmest of margins. But on the other hand, in choosing Gretchen Whitmer, they go for someone who is relatively young and who, if viewers spend more than 30 seconds thinking and learning about her, has a pretty oppositional relationship with Republicans in her state, as opposed to someone like Colorado's John Hickenlooper. It's someone who just spent her whole State of the State address addressing things like maternal health and expanded preschool, and who has a pretty, a frictional relationship with the energy industry. Mm-hmm. I'm still a little mystified that she was the choice. Hmm. Compared with some real other contenders around the country. Why her?
You know, in some ways, April, I think the question answers the question. Which is...
That's so meta and not an answer.
Drop mic, gonna go. That she was a choice that has a lot of people going, hey, why her? And sparking a discussion about the sorts of things that maybe you'd want to spark a discussion about in a presidential election year.
Well, she's a governor, right? Like, that's a really big deal for Democrats. They've got to rebuild that the bottom of the bench, the bottom of the pyramid. That's super critical. And the fact of the matter is that she delivered, like, people were questioning, is Michigan a purple state? What does this mean? You had 8 years of total homogenous Republican rule, and you had someone who finally switched it. So as far as the national spotlight is concerned, for Democrats, Whitmer is it, right? I mean, you're talking about someone who hollowed out, I mean, from top to bottom. I mean, Democrats have been out of the game for a very, very long time, and she put Michigan back in play. So from a national standpoint, she is exactly the face that that the D's want.
Nancy Pelosi's taking a big risk on her because, number one, she's charismatic. Number two, if she stays on message, and I've worked in conjunction with her for over 8 years, if she sticks to her message and she delivers the points that she can make, she can be a very effective communicator. That's number two. Number three is that she does have deep ties to the unions and to other organizations that they need. And really, if you're looking at this from the 3,000 feet up level, Nancy Pelosi's not looking at does she have any baggage, is there something going on? She's relatively new, relatively fresh, charismatic, and can deliver good communication. And when you're the Speaker of the House, and that's who's making the decision, you're going to pick your best horse to make the run. And really, if you're going to center on the Midwest, she would be the one to pick.
She's it.
And nationally speaking, too, let's not forget in 2015 or 2014, before the Flint water crisis, there was a lot of talk about Rick Snyder as a possible VP candidate, which now just sort of seems just
that
astonishing.
Was John Yab and Chuck Yab.
Well, there were some folks that were floating it, but nationally he was a name, which I think goes back to the idea that Michigan has always sort of been of this Midwest idea, and could that then, you know, get Ohio, although April, I think you would know much more about that, you know, does a Gretchen Whitmer as a VP somehow, you know, get other Midwestern states or not? That
well, and Ohio is treated in a similar fashion in these discussions.
Yeah.
Well, look at what Tim Kaine did for Hillary Clinton in Virginia.
Right.
And
right.
Historically, it's not always a slot for a vice president selection. I mean, it's really not, because you've got to look at all the other folks that are in this race in Iowa. There's seven, you know, there's a lot of them, and a lot of them dropping out, or when they decide to leave, will play a role in negotiating who is the VP candidate, who is the Secretary of Education, who is the Secretary of Transportation, who's the Secretary of Labor, right? So he's got, whoever the nominee is, has considerations to give to the field that he or she is currently battling in Iowa tonight. But what it does do is raise to the level that the Democratic Party is recognizing they made a very bad mistake in 2016 by ignoring Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania.
If you want to play a drinking game in Michigan over the next few months, anytime a Democratic elected official says, the road to the White House runs through Michigan, take a drink. Because just this past week...
But don't drive.
No. Don't. Especially not on these roads.
Wouldn't be so. Wasn't safe
you mean
before
damn
you
roads.
Took a drink.
Right, exactly. More questions, please.
Where does Michigan end up in 2020? Does the House go Democratic? Does it go Democratic for the president?
Girl.
Where does that end? Sorry.
That's not fair.
She always asks the hardest questions.
Selma?
Oh, goodness. my guess is that Michigan will likely revert to form as far as its electoral college votes are concerned. You might see a switch in the House. I doubt you'll see one in the Senate. Talk to us again after gerrymandering gets addressed after the census. I think you might see a little more play there. But I think the best that the Dems can likely hope for is a flip of the House. But I actually think that the road to the White House runs through Wisconsin.
Okay.
And have you done the math
here? Where they're holding the Democratic convention, we should say, too.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
You're right.
So someone's done the math here. What happens if Michigan and Pennsylvania go back to being blue? It's a tie.
I love it.
If Trump can hold all of his states,
hence Pennsylvania.
Good chance he will. Say that again.
Hence Pennsylvania.
Well, Pennsylvania could go blue, and it could still be a tie. And what happens once it's a tie?
House of Representatives, right?
Well, Nebraska splits their votes, don't they? Is it? Yeah. Well,
yeah,
but we know where Nebraska's going to go.
Yeah, you can get switched. Right,
okay,
right.
So,
but if the House of... But
you need to repeat what Lex just said.
It's the national.
That Nebraska shares their electoral votes, that it's not
they
a winner-take-all.
It's not a winner-take-all.
Proportional.
Right. But then doesn't it go to the House of Representatives?
Yes, it does. It goes to the House of Representatives. And you can get a split. You could actually get a tie vote in the Senate as well. I mean, the whole thing is, it's just bananas. It's absolutely bananas.
Could
and I think if you game it out like Nancy Pelosi becomes president...
No, there is. Well, remember
seriously.
When now we're getting really
guys,
into the weeds.
In 2000, there was some idea that Al Gore, during the whole Chad stuff, was actually going to have to vote in a tie between Democrats and Republicans in the Senate because he was Senate President Pro Tem as the vice president. Could you have imagined how bonkers that would have been if you're like yourself and you're like, I give it to myself.
Well, they can't.
But that didn't happen.
And you also have to take into consideration that Iowa and, Ohio, it tends to lean red, but he's not done any favors for those folks that he promised in terms of the labor workforce and other things in Ohio. So slight shifts in some of these states that were close could offset what you're saying, but yeah, absolutely. It could get kind of wild, but that's sort of Donald Trump.
You guys
Trump.
Are blowing my mind.
And can we also just also talk blowing mind that like Gore versus Bush was 20 years ago? That is crazy.
Don't remind me.
Okay, do we have questions on this side? Hands, please.
Quiet bunch tonight.
Okay,
we bored them to death.
Is there not enough mead
flowing? Let's talk about Michigan, because so we've got Super Tuesday coming up, and that will be what I like
March
to call
3rd.
The great winnowing, when we're going to see people drop out. Then what comes the week after that?
We do.
Michael Bloomberg.
No, after that, we will have the mini Tuesday, where we've still got... How many states is it, Matt? I mean, is it 10?
Super Tuesday?
A mini Tuesday, when Michigan is in.
I think there's 6 or 7 on March 10th.
7. And Michigan, I think, is the biggest state, although there are going to be...
7 million population member growing, yeah.
Yeah, so... It's going to be a smaller race. It's going to be an important group of states, but I suspect that after Tuesday that we will see a convergence of the remaining candidates on Michigan trying to keep it alive through the rest of the season.
Well, Bloomberg is spending billions of dollars in anticipation for this very scenario. I mean, he is.
Yeah.
And even though he said, listen, no matter what happens, I'm going to turn my machine over to whatever candidate wins, which is... frankly, in my opinion, pretty noble on his part because he doesn't have to. But if the spending of between he and Steyer continue, the race kind of hits a period of time after South Carolina and Nevada where there's this really weird down period, and then we see what billions of dollars that have been pumped into these Super Tuesdays and Secondary Tuesday, if you will, for Michigan races.
We need to come up with a snappier name for that follow-up.
Right, we need to brand that.
Mike Bloomberg has spent, can you actually guess how much money on ads just right now? And this is, tonight is Iowa, right? So just until before the first real vote has happened, how much money? Do you guys know?
$100 million, $150 million.
$250 million, a quarter of $1 billion. Imagine what you
Steyer has spent.
Yeah.
Probably a quarter of that, maybe a little bit more, which is insane.
$350 million.
And I think Trump has spent $75 million.
The first vote. So I want to talk a little bit more about...
do we have a question?
The primaries tonight. Yes, we do. So let's talk a little bit about tonight and the folks that absolutely have to come out of it in the top two, the top three, right? Or else we're basically just saying goodbye to them. I mean, is it fair to say like an Amy Klobuchar, if she's not in the top three tonight, it's...
No.
No?
She won in France. She won in the satellite France Iowa caucus event before I got here. 17 people showed up with Iowa voting cards in France and supported
this
her.
Is the overseas,
so maybe that's a good sign.
Are you this making is the a overseas prediction, Marston?
The overseas caucuses.
No.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the overseas caucuses.
Yeah, which is just okay. Amazing. I love that.
No, I think Amy Klobuchar is still in it. Like I think most of them are still in it because it sounds like, I mean, what I'm hearing is that Sanders has an okay chance at winning in Iowa tonight and then again in New Hampshire, which is somewhat remarkable. But I still think that the race is pretty wide open. I mean, we probably won't see a winning until Super Tuesday.
With this many people in, of course it's still wide open.
I think the poor gentleman from Colorado, who I think is a very nice man and has great ideas, and I can't remember his name, and that's part of the problem. But I... yes, sir. Thank you. I think he, you know
it's Michael Bennett.
Michael Bennett is an unfortunate because he's a very smart man and seems very kind and has good ideas. I think he's out. I think Yang, unfortunately, probably is not going to survive this. And I think that probably it costs money to run these things, and these guys' funds are going to dry up. And when you're looking at a Klobuchar, she's probably flying right now by just the string on her purse to get going further. So without a win tonight, she'll have some trouble in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we had a question.
I'm not into this world like you are, but I'm going to bring a human.
You are so
thank God.
I'm a voter.
Take us with you.
No,
but
I like it.
I see Governor Whitmer as a leader, and she has backbone. This vaping thing, she's the only governor that came out and is protecting our children. There may be others, but I know she did for sure. Even the president started backing down on that vaping. And she stood strong. She cares about people. She cares about her children. I mean, I don't want to sound too sappy about her. But, I mean, compared to what we had before, oh, my gosh.
You are obviously a fan.
I am. And believe it or not, I mean, the woman is human. I just think she's just, she, even in her state talk, it was all about people.
Yeah.
And education and... Even manufacturing, she's just said, okay, guys, Sharkey, Chapman, Chatfield, if you don't want to work with me, I'll work with people in the field.
But are you really okay with that? I mean, if it was someone on the right, right? So if it was someone on the right who said the exact same thing, would you have the same reaction that, well, you don't want to work with me left, so I'm just going to move on by myself?
Well, they just sit on there. You saw them at the State of the State. That's what she's up against. I mean, I don't know her. I've never met her personally. But that's what she brings to me as a voter. She's human, and she cares about human beings. And we aren't widgets. We're people. We care. We have lives.
Yeah. Well, her messaging is getting through.
And you're absolutely right. And she also knows how to pull the long knife out when it needs to, in political terms, to do what she needs to do, because she spent 8 years dealing with Mike Bishop and Randy Richardville in the Senate, which is...
Who'd you work for?
All of them.
Randy Richardville, Mike Bishop.
One point or
so
another.
So she was going up against you.
Yeah, that might be. Gentlemen. She doesn't like me so much.
Gentlemen, just to say, so you have a question, though.
I don't have a question. It's pure comment. But I have, for the first time in my life, and I'm not a newbie, and I have called the office and guess what? You get someone. You get someone with the pulse, and they talk to you.
That's a big
deal.
Imagine
such a thing. That is a big deal to me as a voter, yeah. That human contact.
Yeah. Sure. I'll tell you, Garland Gilchrist, actually, I think like it's once a week as the lieutenant governor, he sits and he takes the calls and people flip out when he answers. It's super sweet.
It's just such a breath of fresh air.
That's what they're supposed to do. Really? That's not many. It's a lot. It's gone the way the dodo.
Governors have tried that periodically. Jennifer Granholm did it.
Listen.
No, meeting.
John Engler, do you think he was going to answer a phone call and you and I covered him and hang on?
No, but he did the Ask the Prime Minister thing where he would, do the office hours. Rick Snyder tried something similar. Jennifer Graham.
Also go, oh, my God, here comes Pluto. Here comes Rick. Can you, let's move him away.
It's true. We've got a question way in the back.
Hi, I just wanted to say that when you said that they floated Snyder for vice president or higher office, it was interesting that it was probably Flint water that kept him from floating higher. Sorry, bad joke. Anyway, yeah. All right.
Actually, well, another thing funny. Too, I sort of it enjoyed
not,
it.
Anyway.
It is not remotely unusual.
Because it broke just after they were talking about him doing other things. So. Yeah. But no, but the actual question was this. I was just trying to lighten it up. So the question is this. With Trump and with Bernie Sanders, you have national parties who have had people who don't identify as really members of those parties get a lot of traction in the last couple of years. And I think the question is what do parties stand for anymore? Are we in a post-party environment? Mm-hmm. And do they really help? And I'm just trying to figure out what's the way forward in this. And what do parties stand for? Like, I know what Democrats sort of stand for. Actually, I think that's why they picked Whitmer to do the state of the to do the responses, because she actually talked about issues and beliefs and what she stands for. I don't really know what Republicans stand for these days, but that's a whole other thing. But what do the parties stand for? What is their role going forward in the next cycle, next 10 years?
So, I mean, I think what you're talking about, right, is Trump, who was a Democrat and gave lots of money to Democrats before he ran as a Republican. I think there's a quote where he said, I have to run in the Republican Party because they're the dumb ones who will elect me as a Republican. It's an actual quote. And then you
paraphrased.
And then there is Bernie Sanders, right, who actually identifies as an independent and is a caucus of one. Matt, when it comes to kind of, what we learned in poli-sci, professor, sort of the cult of personality versus organized parties, what does the Republican Party today, not the, Republican Party that you think might have left you, but what does the Republican Party today stand for?
Nothing I understand. I mean, nothing that 25, 27 years I spent in service to Republican elected officials, not because it was like I'm a Republican. It was just sort of like you got out of college at James Madison and you got a job in a mailroom. And it happened to be for Governor Engler. And then from there you went to communications. And then from there you went on to campaigns. And it was not necessarily a choice that people in my seat or anyone else's seat, you say, well, I'm going to do this in part and parcel. It's a function of just how the system works from a staff and advisor standpoint. But I think that really if somebody came to Rev6 Data Systems and said, we want to get elected, I'm going to say to you, listen, we already know what the base is over here on this side, and we already know what the base is over on this side. And part of Bernie is the progressive movement, and part of Trump is the far right. We'll just leave it at that base. Mm-hmm. Where are the independents? Who are they? And how do you communicate with them? Because these are people that have very mixed opinions on things, and you have to be able to talk to them and say, listen, on this issue you disagree, but on this issue you do agree. And how do you do that? And that really falls on the people that these campaigns hire to get the candidate to understand you can't speak just to your base. You have to talk to the people that are in the middle.
Selma, let's talk a little bit, you know, that's the Republican Party view. If you look at Democrats, I mean, not everything is roses and rainbows and unicorns and birthday cakes. You had Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib on stage over the weekend booing Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, she was pretty serious about that boo.
It was a serious boo. So we've spent some time talking about, you know, Republican Party and the conflicts within the party. I mean, Democrats, it's no piece of birthday cake right now.
No, and it is not peaches and ice cream. The left is in a. So the question was, what does I'll come to you as well, Zoe. What does the party do? The party is, to me, I think the party is all about money, and it is all about money. It's all about infrastructure and the politics. And this is what Trump does so well. That man has his finger on the pulse of his base all the time. You know, you have to give him that from a communication standpoint. That guy knows how to spin a message like nobody else, and that's what he does. And so for him, he just goes where the messaging is the hottest, right? He doesn't necessarily need a fulsome win. He doesn't need it to actually be a policy that necessarily effectuates what he said he wanted to do. He just needs something that he can talk about. And so that's where the politics comes in, is do you have a great messenger, and then do you have a party that can help you operationalize that message? And that's what Republicans are doing for them. And much to your chagrin, Matt, that's what Trump has done, is he's redefined the message, and he owns it, and he says, all right, now somebody else come and organize it and help me carry this thing through. And, you know,
but all these folks out here have to understand that's 33% of the country. 35 at best. That's who he's talking to every day. So
we'll absolutely go out and vote for him.
Absolutely, that's his base. So think about
that. Which is not true on the left.
I don't know the nuances of the left, but it's not true. He's got all.
Well, what about this 35%. In 2016? Remember the Bernie Bros? That there was like this crossover. That
feel the burn, man.
But people who would support either Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, that was the thing.
Where are they?
So, Matt, as a strategist and as a consultant, what are those issues right now then that you could look at and say, this is the messaging, right? This is the group of folks who could go Republican, who could go Democrat. What are you saying to them? What are you telling your candidate to talk about and be for and pitch?
To your point, healthcare, education.
But we're all talking. I mean, all the parties
But you've got the Republican side that's saying, "We're gonna rip up Obamacare, blah 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 blah." Obamacare.
They don't talk about healthcare.
But the reality, the independents are going, "Well, geez, you know, my insurance is up. This is concerning to me. I'm not like as a middle class person. I'm not rich because of these tax cuts." Like, there are many people out there that he's talking to that I don't think understand that his message is satisfying a base of people at 33 to 35% in states that are so different from what we're dealing with as Michigan voters, that it's hard to say what that message should be, really, other than it's all Trump all the time, and you're either with him or you're against him, and if you're against him, he's going to bring all the guns against you, and you're done. Mm-hmm. I'll primary you.
We have another question. State your name.
You know who I am.
That's your mom.
It's my mom.
It's your mom. My mom's right behind her.
You're putting questions in the audience, Zoe.
Okay, no, you're right. She's not. Go ahead. She actually worries when the microphone comes to me, I think.
We are so worried right now.
Okay. To go back a minute to when you were talking about the people who were either for our current president or for Bernie, what I wondered is, do you have a take on though that group of people in Michigan who didn't want, they were saying they were voting for their conscience. Mm-hmm. And so they wouldn't vote, they voted for Bernie even though they knew that he wouldn't win. And so for people who wanted Hillary, it became this kind of like, oh, are you thinking ahead to the Supreme Court nominees? Are you thinking ahead to policy? Are you thinking ahead about issues that will actually affect people day to day? And I wonder if you have any sense of that group of people and where they are now, how they feel about it now, you know, almost 4 years later.
There was a great conversation on NPR, actually.
Stop it. Did you have a driveway moment?
I did. And it was about Pennsylvania and the union voters in Pennsylvania, and how the, and I'm sure somebody in here has heard this thing, about how union voters in Pennsylvania are really struggling between the left flank of the Democratic Party and with Trump, because the left flank, the Sanders and the Warrens, are anti-fracking. And they're saying, that is our livelihood. If you take fracking away from us, like, you're just going to leave me out here with a hope and a prayer. And then they replayed this tape of Hillary Clinton talking with Tim Kaine about how she said she was going to stop fracking. And the question is like, what? So all Democrats are super, super worried about who is going to beat Trump, and that's pretty much all they care about. But yet they have policies that are anathema to the states that they need to win. So the question is, and Sanders and Warren will tell you, if you make a play for our policies, you will get the disaffected youth, the millennials and the Zs in the world, to come out and vote in times where they did not vote before.
I was going to say the least likely voters.
The least likely voters, which is what Trump did, right? So the
remember and so when did Ron, Obama.
And so did Obama. Well, Obama had a pretty diverse coalition.
In 08, like, he tapped into young voters.
Well, yes, and no one else could build, you know, no one else could rebuild that Obama coalition. But what's fascinating is, I think that what Trump did, you remember when Romney was running and they said how long the Republican Party has to diversify. They've got to get more Latinos supporting them. They have to get more people of color supporting them. And they said, how many elections can we win with majority white support alone? We've got to do better in these groups. And Trump is saying, no, we're going to keep going. We're going to keep going with this base, with the much more homogenous, which is the white base.
But how much of that is actual Trump support versus, Matt, as you said, you know, the 33%? I mean, let's talk about the largest block of voters in the United States are not voters. They're the non-voters, yeah. Right?
Right.
So, I mean, really, as you were talking about, it's, what, 25%, 26% of the United States population that voted for Trump, another 25. I mean, it was like 0.002, but that Hillary, of course, won in the popular vote.
I think it's similar by county. Let's not talk about it nationally for purposes of this conversation.
Okay.
Let's dial it down to Michigan, right? Macomb County, that's where he won. Mm-hmm. And he also won, or she lost, mm-hmm. in Wayne County, mm-hmm. by a dropout of mm-hmm. people in a general election, not necessarily a primary, that were not able to get out. So every state is won by these counties, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, certain geographical areas. Kalamazoo County, mm-hmm. super important. Mm-hmm. Super important.
Yeah.
Traverse City County, super important. Oakland County. What did Oakland County do? They bucked Trump. They went blue. Mm-hmm. Macomb, labor, driven by. Now, why do you think when he went to Macomb the other day, he goes, guess what? I'm going to bring everybody some F-35s. I'm going to put F-35 planes into Selfridge. So 8 years ago, when there was a BRAC commission, we lost Battle Creek Air National Guard Base.
A BRAC commission is the military commission that decides what bases are going to remain open.
When you shut those bases down, do you understand the amount of jobs that are lost in those communities? It's not insignificant. I mean, think about, there used to be a big military air base up in the UP that was lost two BRAC commissions ago, and look at what the population is and what the economic standards is of the UP. Macomb County, to get F-35s, that's a huge squadron of jets. That's a lot of jobs. He's not a fool. He came in here and said, at Dana Corporation, going to give you guys a new flight strategy. That's going to keep Macomb. He has to have it. Now it's going to become incumbent upon the Democrats to make sure Wayne County's population is not where it was the last presidential year.
Well, let me turn a question on you guys. And it's, there are two kinds of campaigns, and I realize that it's not purely one or purely the other, but there is a focus. One is the persuasion campaign, the one where you try and find people who are persuadable, even if they're not with you right now, but you can persuade them. So is this going to be, and the other one is a turnout campaign. You identify the people who are with you, and then you do everything you can to get them to the polls. In the upcoming, is this going to be a persuasion campaign primarily or a turnout campaign? I have my own opinion, but I want to hear yours.
Depends on the state.
I mean, in Michigan.
In Michigan, I think that it is going to be a turnout campaign.
For sure. In presidential election years, it always is. Because here's the thing. You know going into it, your subset of data is going to be higher in a presidential year than it is in a gubernatorial year, right? It's just the way it works. So you already know you've got a little bit of a snowball rolling down the hill in terms of the turnout in a presidential election year. Now, it's finding those folks that are those independents and those folks that are like, I'm not inspired like Bernie inspired me. I'm not inspired like Obama inspired me. I'm not inspired, okay, where are you? Where do you live? What county are you in? What is your total population base? And how do I communicate to you in a form that makes you want to work?
But that is why the left has to be thinking about who they're putting up, because if you're kind of like meh, you know, and Trump probably looks maybe a little bit chaotic to you, you just need something that is just refuge. You just need safe refuge.
Is it refuge, or do you just not turn out and vote a la Hillary?
That's what happens. They get disenfranchised after the primary, and that's a function of what happens.
Right. So, more questions. Sorry, because we'll just keep going.
Yeah, just a quick question for you guys.
No, it can be as long as you want.
Well, thank you. Do you think a lot of these issues? Yeah. Here. Do you think a lot of these issues could be ironed out if you were to switch to a ranked voting system, similar to how they have Maine? We wouldn't have so much of this concentration located regionally. It'd be more dispersed evenly across all of those different groups.
Yeah,
Too late.
You know, I've always been a fan of proportional system of government, and I also I wouldn't mind more parties. So I actually think anything. I don't want to say
more political parties.
More political parties and an easier more parties. I am a fan of more parties too.
And
our glasses are almost empty. What's happening? So access to representation, I think that could be one. So I'm going to take your question broadly. Greater access to representation where you've got sort of these balkanized and these smaller factions where they can find a home and get representation in a government. I mean, that's how most systems do it. And you have to create a government and a parliamentary system of government. I think that that's maybe not the worst idea to break the fever in this country. I think the other one is addressing gerrymandering, which is going to be really critical to make moderate decisions something that are more prevalent and are easier to break through.
More swing districts.
I think that have more competitive races. Like, really work for those votes. You should have to really toil for them. It shouldn't be so easy. So I do think proportionality is important, and I also think that access to greater representation is important.
Matt, and quickly, because we want to get to one more question.
Gerrymandering. The new board, or however this plays out, I'm just going to tell everybody, has a very difficult task ahead of them. By way of disclosure, having worked to draw the Senate maps, which were not the House maps in the state legislature,
you'll be having a bodyguard with you as you walk to your car tonight.
It's very difficult for everybody to understand that when they draw that there's a certain number of people that you have got to put in those boxes. And sometimes there's rivers, and sometimes there's lakes, and sometimes there's roads that cut through neighborhoods. And I am I'm ecstatic that they're going to undertake this, but it is going to be challenging. And to answer your question, I would have to put on my James Madison College hat, and we'd be here for hours to answer your question. But the thing about it is that I think what you're seeing in slow increments is what you're seeing in Iowa today. They have changed their... Does anybody understand a caucus? I don't. I've studied it for a while. They're even making little adjustments
just this time
to try and kind of get to where you're going. But a wholesale change in democracy requires constitutional adjustments that are really heavy, folks. We couldn't even get an impeachment done, let alone changing how we're going to accept different voting standards.
Okay, we're going to go to, we have another question. She gets to hold the microphone.
Okay, well,
you get to ask the question.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Gary Peters. I get requests for money from him daily. I don't really honestly know a lot about him. And then I read that he might actually vote to acquit Trump.
Oh, April Baer and I might have been having a conversation about this exact article in the New York Times.
It was in the Times, yes.
With a byline of someone, no offense, but I would wonder the last time that they set foot in our state. So let's start with this Gary Peters conversation about could he possibly vote to acquit. No, we've got a few more minutes. So here's the New York Times article basically took a list of some Democrats. We're talking Gary Peters, who is up for re-election come November, as well as Manchin and a few other Democrats that tend to be moderate, let's use that word just to be quick about it, and kind of posited the idea, Matt, might they possibly vote to acquit? And what I was saying to April is the amount of Democratic support that Gary Peters would lose in Michigan voting to acquit doesn't equal the amount of support that some Republicans or independents might come out and vote for him and help him win in 20.
Any disagreement on the
panel? No. I mean,
I know.
I mean, she's exactly right.
I know.
Now, on Manchin, to your point, though, that's a different situation because he's looking at a gubernatorial bid in a West Virginia state that has got opiate problems all over the place. Coal mining industry was supposed to be supported. It's not being supported. If he's going to say, you know what, I'm kind of done with this and I want to run for governor, Gary Peters isn't running for governor of Michigan. Gary Peters is riding a motorcycle, and he's a vet that isn't a vet and whatever. But he's also been one of those senators that Debbie Stabenow, who is a very effective constituent service deliverer, she is up there every day standing next to Schumer.
Yep.
She is doing what she needs to do, and Gary's just like, listen, man, I'll just blend into the background. Hopefully this John James guy doesn't really knock me off.
Yeah. So exactly. And so I think that there is – yeah. Yes. So is he actually in trouble? Well, let's talk about the different things that one can look at, and one is money. And John James, his opponent, who ran against Debbie Stabenow 2 years ago and lost, became sort of the face of the Republican Party in Michigan. In fact, he's the one that had folks turning out for rallies. He has Donald Trump has tweeted about him. He says he supports Donald Trump 2,000%. And we saw some numbers come out in this last quarter of fundraising, and John James raised a butt ton of money. And so it's not unlikely for Gary Peters to start emailing his base with subject lines, because we get them too. Tell me your name. So it's, Judy, I'm writing to you because I'm in trouble. Right? I know.
Yeah.
I know.
I sign up for those lists because one of the things that I want to see is how our candidates' fundraising themes match the other ones.
No, we get them.
By all means, do it. You need more.
I get plenty, and they are very, very, very consistent. You know, and not unlike, you know, the emails I get after I buy a pair of shoes, that it's like, we've got a deal for you, but you need to
My
do
favorite
it right
is
now.
In the parentheses where it says sent from iPad.
Yeah.
Gary's from personal iPad. No, yeah. That's not happening.
But no, you're being marketed.
But Matt, is Gary, you know, as a Republican strategist, John James seems sort of limitless in his popularity among Republicans in Michigan. Is Gary Peters in trouble?
No. I mean, everybody's in trouble. It's running in any given election cycle. That's just the bottom line. If you're advising a campaign, you're in trouble, okay? That's the job of people like myself and anybody else.
What's the line? There's only one place to run from, and that's like you're losing?
It's lost. You run with everything. I think that he'll have the support of the Senate Democratic Campaign Committee. I think that Trump will probably overplay his hand on John James and being and using his completely inappropriate, like, this is my racially different best friend, if you will, of the most politically correct I can put it, that I don't think is going to help. And I think that there'll be certain areas that do it, but I think that Debbie and the establishment and especially Congressman Dingell, they'll do what needs to be done, and he may take some hits here and there, but if the Democratic Party, both state and federal, are focused and are helping him do what he needs to do, he should win this. And I think that probably Michigan will go back to being blue, I hope.
My other thought about that, too, is this idea that, you know, right now we're talking about impeachment, Selma. It seems like that's all we can talk about. But let's be real. We are in a room in 48103 in Ann Arbor. We're here talking about politics on a Monday night, like really talking, like we're nerding out. How many folks in November are going to remember this vote and decide, right, and have it be deep in them? You know what? Gary Peters voted for or against impeachment. Therefore, I am changing my vote. Selma?
Yeah, that one. They will definitely remember.
No,
that
no, not here. I'm saying in the state of
this
Michigan.
This town will remember.
I'm saying the conversation we are having, this is not happening everywhere in Michigan. I'm asking how many folks are going to remember one impeachment vote this month and have that portend what's going to happen for them in November.
They'll remember because Trump and John James won't let them forget, number one. And number two, the electorate's really fired up. I mean, as a strategist, as far as polling is concerned, you know these folks are so hot about this election. We've not seen numbers like this in a very, very long time. So this is going to be a base turnout election. It's all red meat.
Trump is a turnout machine. And that is, he is a turnout machine whether you love Trump or he's a turnout machine whether you hate Trump. I don't remember the number. I'm sorry, Zoe, you've heard this story a whole bunch of times. I don't remember the exact number, but someone was going through some polling results, and there was some minuscule portion, like 2% of people who were polled, and these were the people who did not have an opinion about Donald Trump. Yeah. And I was just like, what more do you need to know?
Rick was fascinating. He's like, who are these people?
12,000 people in a state of 7 million people.
0.02% Hillary
lost.
Okay,
so I hope everybody that lives in this state or votes in this state that cares about this country remembers what happened. It's not about party. It's about behavior. It's about what you want to have in a president. And it's not partisan. It's just saying, you guys have to go out. And I do this every time you bring me in here. You have to go out and vote.
And we continue to bring you.
You've got to participate. You've got to care. Whatever your party decision is, you need to care. And go out and get your friends and family to go out and stop it.
Mm-hmm. But getting back to, was there a question?
In the back.
Oh, go.
So you've been talking about this being a turnout election, and we have to turn out. And I think there's something significant in Michigan this year that people need to be reminded of. And that is that we now have no reason, no fault absentee ballots.
Yes. Right? You don't have to lie that you're going to be out of town.
We can get people out who can't normally get to the polls.
Yeah. In fact, you could vote right now in Michigan's primary. Absentee ballots have already gone out. Very true.
And it's a good thing, and it's something that it's a double-edged sword, okay? Because it's new. And with that comes the question of, did somebody tamper with the results? How do we know? What's going to happen? You have to remember that it's really incumbent upon the new Secretary of State, and this is a big task for her to handle because a lot was thrown at her to make these changes. We really need to encourage her and the governor to make sure that they've put everything they can in terms of election ballot safety, in terms of there's no reason absentee voting. I don't disagree with it, but I'm telling you, as somebody that spent a lot of time around election results, it opens the door for potential complaints about election validity after the fact if it's not handled appropriately on the front end.
That's incredibly interesting. I also think it's interesting to note that this Secretary of State, one could say then, was elected at the perfect time because Jocelyn Benson literally wrote the book about being a Secretary of State. Like, that is what she did, and now she's Secretary of State. So I'm sort of like, you know, on November, she's going to be like, go to chapter 18, and I'm going to go to my notes.
She is living her raison d'être. Yeah.
I'm going to throw in a plug for the work that we're doing here. Is I'm part of a group of station political directors and Capitol Bureau chiefs, and our number one priority in covering this election season is keeping track of election tampering, potential election tampering, and the ways that that's being combated, because we know. As a matter of fact, I was watching a briefing with really smart people, deputy secretaries of state or former ones, and one of the things that we know about election tampering is that it's happening. I mean, it's not just a potential. And it's being done through propaganda. And quite frankly, our anger is being turned against us in our politics. And that's not an opinion, that's a fact, that our national security teams know this. And some people think that it may be the biggest threat to basically free and fair elections.
And sometimes it's Betty Boop, who's the county clerk someplace that, I mean, by way of disclosure, I've got an absentee.
You work for Betty Boop?
Well, Betty Boop sent me an absentee ballot to one address, and my driver's license is at a different address. Mm. Now, that's a problem that goes down to the local municipal level. So when I talk about election integrity, I'm not necessarily saying the Ukraine or Russia. I'm saying that you've asked clerks that are have been, some of them, with all due respect, a little bit long in the tooth, that keep their results in shoeboxes in their closet, because I've seen them in terms of who they should be figuring out get a ballot. It's that part of the equation. It's a human nature part of the issue, because you are relying on locally elected municipal officials to execute the bottom line of the integrity of the election. And I'm not saying that there's widespread paranoia and everybody should be freaked out, but you guys got to understand, it's not all just Russia. It is, to a certain degree, we have a government that municipalities actually function with this stuff.
It is worth noting that the clerk's office, I used to work for the city of Grand Rapids. I still live in the city of Grand Rapids. And it was one of the most remarkable functions. It is one of the most... It's one of the most remarkable functions of government, of local government, to administer your elections. I mean, if you walk into a clerk's office, what they are doing is incredibly important. It is your access to democracy. And the fact of the matter is that they are bootstrapping, that they tend to not have the resources they need. It comes out of general funds that are in your local governments, and we know how tight those things are. I mean, this thing that we hold so sacred, democracy, we treat it like it's like, yesterday's shoes, because we really don't fund it, and we don't put in the infrastructure that makes it something that is as safe as it could be. It is safe, for the record. But it is incredibly vulnerable. And so, if someone asks you to volunteer at your clerk's office, you should probably do it. It's really, really critical.
On that note, I'd like to think that public radio is doing its part as well in this democracy. And all of you who, again, on a Monday evening came out to talk about politics, you sick, sick people, we're really grateful that you all come to these Issues and Ales. We do believe that we are sort of all doing our part when we can have these discussions where we're not insulting each other and yelling at each other, and can talk about issues like the roads with passion. So thank you very much. I think you guys are going to stick around for a little bit, answer questions after, but let's let people go because it is 8 o'clock
tamales.
On the dime. Okay, thank you so much, everyone. And thank you to Bloom for having us. And I can't tell you again how thrilled I am to welcome April Bear to Michigan Radio. I hope everyone will take a listen to Stateside on Michigan Radio at 3 and 10, because conversations like this are happening on air to break all these things down. So thank you so much, everyone. Get home safely.